Take two. You ready?
Yes, go ahead.
Welcome to the Gary and Kenny Show. Yes, that's already our name simply.
It's already a mess.
It's already a mess. Take three.
No, that was good. I thought that was good.
Okay, it's good. Leave it in.
That I like.
Okay, welcome to the Gary and Kenny Show. We're a little, unscripted, a little loose of a format.
Some of us are intoxicated.
You are, because I'm not.
Oh, you're not? Oh.
I will be by the end of the show.
Oh, okay.
You know, I drink wine. You?
Wine.
Wine. There. I'm in Waterloo, Iowa, and we just got 12 inches of snow. It's 7 degrees. I am surrounded by ice. Kenny, you are in Calabasas, California.
I'm surrounded by Kardashians.
By Kardashians and horses, I assume. Mm-hmm. How are you, Kenny?
It's not important how I am. I want to know how Lee Kernis is.
Well, that's a lovely segue. Both of our guests today are already here. Maybe you can see them. There they are. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. All right? And then I'm going to start drinking. We all really have a long, intertwined career together. The three of you much more than I do. But Morty, I met you, whether you remember or not, in the men's room at 30 Rock on the 6th floor.
Did you blow me?
I don't remember because I was drinking then as well. But first, I would like to introduce Lee Kernis. That name should be familiar to you, a personal manager, a producer. He came up through the ranks at ICM back when I was a client there. He started the comedy department, executive produced Mind of Mencia on Comedy Central, Super Dave Spiketacular on Spike, just to name a couple. Recently, he left Brillstein Entertainment after 19 years and is currently an independent manager producer with a client list that includes Susie Essman from Curb Your Enthusiasm, whom I've worked with, and also Larry Miller, whom I've worked with, Rob Schneider, and I know you're going to tell us about a couple of others. That's Lee, but also we are joined by Robert Morton, better known to the world as Morty. He cut his proverbial teeth as the producer and co-executive producer of Late Night with David Letterman on NBC, made the move over to CBS as executive producer with The Late Show with David Letterman, left in the mid-90s to produce several programs, but then more or less quit the industry, and I want to talk about that, to sell real estate in Los Angeles. I've been doing.
And apparently, he hung out on the 6th floor at the NBC building waiting for blowjobs.
Well, that's where I met him, and we can go into that.
Okay.
But Morty, I did a little math on the commission.
I don't recall that meeting. I know I met you a million times.
A million times. Look, for what it's worth, and maybe this isn't the way to start the show, I was peeing on the 6th floor waiting to see the David Letterman show. David came in, said, "Hi, Gary." I was so flattered that he knew my name. And then you came in and you flanked me to the left to pee to my left. So I was David here and you there, Morty.
Those were the days before Letterman had a dressing room with a bathroom in it.
Apparently. Or he simply chose to use the public room on the 6th floor.
He would use the public restroom. And the funniest thing, and I don't know if you remember this, but he would always drop, it's an old show business thing that when performers pee, they drop their pants, instead of just pulling their penis out of their fly, they drop their pants totally. And it's an old comic thing so that when you do the little tap and you get the rest off, it doesn't get on your pants and then you got to go do a monologue in front of the 3 million people.
I may be reverse engineering my memory, but that's how I remember it now.
Yeah,
and when I tell the story, I'm going to say that he dropped trow and took a pee next to me, and then I gave a blowjob to Morty.
They always drop trow. That's the showbiz. Well, every old comedian. You see Buddy Hackett, Alan King, all the old guys that. And they always wore. You always wonder why comics wear bathrobes. You always see pictures of Rickles or Hackett.
Right.
They're always on camera wearing bathrobes because they don't want to. And it's a great old show business term. They don't want to break the crease in their pants.
They don't want to break the crease.
Break the crease. That's the actual term. So they put their pants on as the very last thing before they go out on stage so they don't break the crease beforehand.
The crease is gone, right? The crease in suits? Nobody has creases anymore.
Not that shit anymore. I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, Garth Brooks, when he did the thing at the inauguration, everybody noticed that he did iron his jeans. And he had creases in his jeans.
Yep. Yeah, they made a big deal out of that.
Yeah, took a lot of shit for that. Well, so Lee, you had mentioned that, you know, I always ask Kenny how he is. How are you, Kenny?
Yes.
On the show. And he said, hey, Lee Kernis gave me a lot of shit about the fact that he couldn't answer the question. How are you, Lee?
I am good. And I just want to go back to that. I hadn't seen the show. Kenny and I were talking a lot during COVID, and he said, have you seen the show yet? I said, no, I got to see it. So the first show I saw, you say to him the first thing, Kenny, how you doing today? And he pauses, he freezes. And he's like, wow. And it takes like 15 seconds, which is a lifetime, for him to say, well, I guess I'm all right or whatever. I said, oh, poor Gary. Poor Gary. He's got to do an hour with this guy. And the first thing he does is ask him how he is, and he can't answer. So I just went crazy, and I called him immediately. I said, listen, I'm 20 seconds into this thing, and I can't even deal with it that you couldn't answer that question.
But you felt bad after I told you the backstory.
Now, I just want to tell you one quick one,
okay,
which is a Kenny story.
Okay.
And it kind of comes back to today. So I've been dating a woman now who I met before I moved to L.A. When I came to L.A. for a week on business with Robert, and we met these two girls at a bar. It was probably 1990, 91, and I moved out at the end of 92. So I dated her kind of when I come out on business until I got here, and then I kind of lost touch with her. So she was married for like 25, 26 years. She got in touch with me on Facebook, and we've seen each other. She's living in Nashville, but she's originally from Santa Barbara.
Did you promise that you would give her a shout out on the show? Is that what's going on, Italy?
No, you'll know what's going on.
Does she charge so, now as she did then?
When I, oh, you son of a bitch, bastard. So when I first met her, you know, I'm looking for places to go on dates. And I think I had a client at Comic Strip Live. So I was like, oh, she'll go to a comedy club. She'd love it. You know, a TV taping. So I remember I said hello. I sat her down. I went to, I guess it was a truck, to say hello to Kenny before. So I said, look, I'm probably not going to see you. So I'm just going to say hello, bop, 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 bop. So we're in the show, and I can see they're taking shots of the audience. They take a shot of her, I mean of me and her. But as soon as the show is over, we walk out, and there he is. He comes around the corner like 80 miles an hour, and he's just standing in front of her. And he's smoking a cigarette, and he's going, so how'd you like the show? And I'm like, you son of a bitch. You just want to see her. You know, nothing to do with me. And it's like, you know, and he's just staring at her. And I'm like, hey, it was a good show. And he's not even looking at me. And I will never forget. You scoped her out on your monitor and ran.
Yeah. Those were the days, Lee. Huh? You can't do that anymore. I'd be accused of the Me Too. I'm going to tell my quick story about how I know Robert Morton.
Love to hear it.
1981.
You want music?
I think it was 1981. A mutual friend of ours at the time, Kathy Vassopoli, now Kathy Schaefer, married to Paul Schaefer, set me up to meet with Morty, who was, I believe your title was creative director at MTV.
Yes.
Walk into the office, a little nervous, want the job, expecting that he will ask me about my studies at NYU. You know, my classes with Haig Menuchin, what I learned in film studies. Or ask me about my previous production experience where I had just worked with the prolific and famous director, George Schaefer. But he didn't ask me about that. What did you ask me, Morty?
I think I asked you if you were a Jew.
Yes, that's exactly what you asked.
And then what did I say? Do you remember the next line?
I think you're hired.
Well, now
we hired people in the old days. You can't do that anymore.
No way.
Are you all three of you New York Jews?
Do you have a theme here?
Yes. I will say this. Okay, I believe Morty is the shrugging Jew. He's the one nothing bothers him. You can say anything to Morty. Morty, the sky is falling. He's like, hey, it falls.
It falls.
It falls.
Okay. Don't be under it.
Right. Lee is, let me tell you what happened, Jew. No, I'll tell you what happened. This is what happened.
The explaining Jew.
The explaining Jew. I am the confused Jew. I'm the Jew walking around going, I don't understand why I have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to fish. Where are the fish in the afternoon? So I'm the confused one. Woody shrugs. And Lee will explain it all to us.
And God forbid anyone should ask the confused Jew how he is today.
That's
right?
Why I am the confused Jew.
I will tell you, being his friend for as many years as I've been his friend and watching him as a producer, you know, I would go out to his house in the Hamptons or something. And, you know, once in a while you get a call from Letterman. Letterman was upset about something. I don't know what. And so, you know, he'd get off the phone and I would say, what was that about? He goes, ah, Letterman, you know, making a mountain out of a molehill. And it's a, like, he never stressed. Like, I never saw him ever stress. It's like, you know, what happened today? Eh, we had a problem. We had this happen. That's
the shrug.
It's like,
I want to know, Morty, how did you get the job? How did you go from creative director at MTV? Next thing you knew, your office was empty. Julian Goldberg moved in and you were the producer on The Letterman Show.
I thought MTV, in my infinite wisdom, I thought MTV was going to be a flop. I thought this is, I said, this place is, and correct me if I'm wrong, there might have been 15 people working there at the time.
That's right.
You know, we were the first, I mean, before you came in, it was me and Sue.
Mm-hmm.
Sue Steinberg was the executive producer. I was the creative director. There was John Sykes, who was mm-hmm. a promotion guy. There was Carolyn Baker, who was a talent person. There was...
Was Sparrow there? Sparrow was there?
Who?
Gail Sparrow.
Gail Sparrow.
Gail was there.
Chip Racklin?
Steve K. Chip wasn't there?
Oh, no, he wasn't there. Steve Casey. Oh, boy, that's somebody that doesn't get talked about.
And there were maybe 10 of us, and we didn't have any offices. Here we are, this big experiment, and we had three rooms at the Sheraton Hotel on 7th Avenue, the Park Sheraton.
Wow.
And we would order from the Carnegie Deli, which was right across the street. And the place, we had these three rooms that stunk of corned beef. It was like being Bialystok and Bloom. We were, you know, the... And people would come and go, what the fuck is this? And, you know, we were doing auditions for VJs in this little tiny room. And, you know, we had a camera. It was before they had home video. I don't even remember what the camera was in those days, Kenny.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did auditions and interviewed people. And, you know, we had to kind of explain that we are credible. Believe me.
There is a story that you got the wrong VJ.
Videos. What was that?
There is a story that you got the wrong VJ.
Yes, there is a story that I got the wrong. Some deny it. Some deny that story is true, but I know it's true.
Can you not go into detail on that?
No, I'll go into detail. He's dead now, the guy we're talking about, so all's fair. We were looking for VJs, and Bob Pittman, who was the chairman of the company, says to me and to Sue, who were in charge of the whole hunt for the original VJs, they said, we need a black VJ. And we said, okay, you know, that's fair. And he said, I know this guy. His name is J.J. Johnson. And he's great. He's good looking. He's great. And I knew who he was talking about. The guy was, because it was in the days when TWA was still around. And he used to do the in-flight stuff on TWA. And there was always a picture of him in the back of the little TWA magazine. And he was this good looking black guy. And I said, okay, I know who he is. We'll bring him in. I couldn't find him. I called TWA. They were no help. I called AFTRA. They were no help. I called all the radio stations. I called every union. Finally, I called, what station was it in San Francisco? KGO or Kron? One of those.
I wouldn't know. Yeah.
One of the big radio stations in San Francisco. And they said, oh, we have J.J. Jackson here. And I said, J.J. Jackson? Oh, I said, what does he look like? I didn't want to say, is he black? You know, it's like, I'm trying to be a little politically correct. I said, what does he look like? He goes, well, he's a black man. Oh, great, great.
That's him. That's him.
Close enough.
Let me talk to him. I spoke to him. He put himself on tape. I got the tape. I put it on Pittman's desk. I said, here's JJ.
JJ.
And Pittman said, oh, yeah, he's good. And we hired him. And JJ was a great VJ.
Terrific. He seemed to sort of anchor it to me watching. You know, he was the more fatherly figure.
He was a lovely man. He was one of the nicer people you'll ever meet.
Did JJ Johnson ever hear this story?
You know, I told it to Rolling Stone. It's in a few books. I'm sure he's heard it.
Okay. So, Robert, you were at MTV. You were at MTV. You were there for, I don't know, a couple of months. You left before we launched, right?
Yeah, for a little less than a year.
But you left before we launched.
I left right before the launch, yeah.
How did you get the gig at Letterman? How did you go from that to Letterman?
Well, I had to stop in between.
I didn't know that.
What happened was I still wanted to get broadcast TV out of my system. I thought, you know, all right, it's good cable. That's good thing to do at the end of your career when your broadcast career is over. I was always in the mindset there are three networks, not four at the time. There was NBC, CBS, and ABC. So, you know, I wanted to make it to the top of that ladder before I did anything else. I just had to resolve that urge. And I got offered a job on Good Morning America as a writer / associate producer. It was a Writers Guild job. I would be in charge of, not in charge, I had a boss over me, but she was a friend of mine. She was the one that offered me the job, Tori Baker, her name was. And I was the guy that was producing the 5-part series that they did on Sweeps Weeks. So, you know, celebrity couples, and I'd have to travel around the country and get Helen Reddy and Jeff Wald on tape, you know, stuff like that. And it was a fun job. And I was on the road a lot. I was single. And I was paid as a writer. They made the mistake of paying me as a writer and a producer. So I would go out and do these 14, 15-hour shoots and put in for golden time and travel time and short turnaround and all this stuff that you can get in the guild. And I was making more money than the producer of the show. I was making a fortune on that show. And I thought, that is pretty good. Then I get a call from... I'm sure we all know Stu Smiley, who was my college roommate. And we're coming up. We've known each other now for 50 years, 50th anniversary. And he called me up. He was we were pages together at CBS. Our careers have kind of always been in tandem. And he called me up. He was a manager at the time working for Rollins and Joffe, who in that day were the biggest comedy managers in the world. They had Woody Allen, they had Robert Klein, they had Billy Crystal, they had, you know, anybody who's anybody in comedy, they managed them. So they also had this young guy named David Letterman. So this is, I'm talking now 1980. Before I worked at MTV, I got an offer to produce Letterman's morning show.
That's right. He had a morning show.
Yes. And I was working at NBC then on the Tomorrow Show. My boss was Roger Ailes, who hated me because I was a hippie, curly-haired Jewish liberal. He couldn't stand me, and he fired me.
Wow.
Anyway, before I got fired, I was offered the Letterman show, the morning show that he was doing. I was 1980. I was 26, 27 years old.
You offered this, but had you ever met David beforehand? Had any experience with David beforehand?
Yeah, I met him once at the Comedy Store when he was, before he was on TV, before he had anything. And he was nice enough. I didn't see the next Johnny Carson, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I thought he was a good, you know, functioning stand-up comic, had a nice little act, had a good look. He was clean cut, you know, Midwestern kid. But I didn't see, you know, everybody was touting him. Smiley, oh, he's the next next Johnny Carson. And I'm, I don't quite see it. Anyway, I get called up. I'm an associate producer on the Tomorrow Show. An associate producer in those days was like right under a producer. Now associate producer, you know, you get coffee. It's a little different. So I get a call to go up to the president of the network's office. Brandon Tartikoff, right? I go up to Tartikoff, or was it Silverman? I don't remember, one of the two of them. I go up to their office, and it's the late night executives, and one of the late night executives who you might know, Nancy Geller, who's now a producer, very nice woman, good friend. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know her then. And she looked at my resume and she said, oh, you live on Riverside Drive. Isn't that nice? And, you know, that's kind of the icebreaker. And they offer me this job. I go back and I tell Tom Snyder that I got offered the job. He goes, don't worry, I'm going to make you the producer of this show. You don't need to go there. So I passed. The real reason I passed was my girlfriend at the time was a talent coordinator on the show. And she said to me, I'm not going to work for you. I was so blindly in love with this woman that I said, okay, I'm not going to take the job. 26 years old, being offered a producer of a major morning show. Now cut to Good Morning America. And I get the call from Smiley, we're starting a late night show. Do you want to come on? We can't give you the producer's job because the guy that took the job when I passed on it, Barry Sand, is going to be the producer. So I took the number two job and I left Good Morning America and I went to Letterman. I was there for 14 years.
Yeah.
Over 14 years.
Unbelievable.
I was just going to say, all of these stories that we're telling are so, they're such great examples of things that we did that are completely unacceptable now. Hiring you because you were a Jew. You can't do that anymore. I can't ask you what religion you are. Saying dirty things to women, you know, they've taken all the fun out of things.
Well, there is a narrative,
Morty. Yeah.
There's a narrative. Go ahead, Kenny. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say something really politically incorrect. So,
well, I noticed a narrative theme with girlfriends. All of your stories start with,
Lee is my only guy I know who's been a lifelong bachelor.
Yes, I have been.
A lifelong bachelor. Unbelievable.
Never got married, huh?
Never got married, no. And no kids that I know of, but... But I want to just say something.
That's how you have to say it, though. You can't say never got married. The way to make it really pierce his heart is you say, so you never married.
So you never married.
Right.
But here's what I want to say. I was around this guy, you know, and I left the business and I wanted to get as far away from the business as I could. And when I was young, I went into commercial real estate. My uncle had a friend who was president of a big company on Wall Street. And I said, I want to do this. I want to learn something else. I went to real estate school at night at NYU, got my license, worked for about 8 years in real estate. So I was out of the business and I got friendly with Robert and he's every night. He's like, come on, I got to go by the improv. Come on, I got to go by, we'll eat dinner after. I got to go by. So I'm seeing all these comics, you know, Paul Reiser, Seinfeld, all these guys I knew when I was in the business who, you know, were pretty much just starting out. But it was like, you know, you say, well, it was New York in the 80s, but it felt like, compared to today, it felt like New York was probably like in the 50s or 40s. Because, yeah, the way you spoke to people, the way, and it wasn't disrespectful, and I don't think I ever saw him disrespect anybody, man or woman, but there was a camaraderie and a kidding. You could kid in a way that you could never do now. Right. So the way I looked at what he was doing with my date, besides trying to scam, you know, was he's just joking around. I mean, you never took it like, and it's the one thing I want to say is like, you know, if you look at, text today and they say, well, there's no tone, whatever. When you talk to somebody and you're flirting or whatever, there's tone, there's the words, but you can't, there's nothing today that compares to what that was.
I think you can't do sarcasm on text, can you? Does sarcasm translate? No.
Does it have an icon? No.
And I was, and that sarcasm, I live off of sarcasm.
It's context and nuance is lost. Yeah.
It's anti-irony television. You know, you look at the shows that are successful. You look at Schitt's Creek, which I love. It's the kindest, sweetest, nicest, most politically correct.
Right.
I mean, you look at what's the Ted Lasso. Have you seen that one?
No. Yeah. Do you like it?
It's great. It's great. But it's all positive image. It's all, there's no irony. There's no sarcasm. It's very straightforward. And, you know, we come from a different time.
Well, Lee, you're in the thick of it, you know. Susie Essman, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah. I assume she's coming back for season.
Filming now, yes.
Filming right now. Well, that's a show that kind of said fuck it to all the things that we're talking about. Don't care. What's that experience like? Working with Susie, does she love it? I mean,
Well, I would say one thing about what you just said about Curb. So Curb started in, I don't know, 2001 or something like that. Before all this stuff happened, before Me Too and, you know, everything that goes along with that. So Larry's personality was ingrained enough up until the years that this happened where, because if you look back on some of those old Curbs, you know, he gets excited when a female tailor hems his pants. You know, things happen that nobody would probably write today. But Larry being Larry, his character was ingrained years before this. So, and to me, that's great because he's a real person with real thoughts, and you just don't get that anymore. And it's changed a lot with how comedy is thought of today.
I still want Seinfeld episodes, and I think there's a certain Seinfeld episodes that you could never do today. I mean, they had a lot of ethnic humor and, comedy and that. Yes. And speaking of Seinfeld.
Even Soup Nazi, right.
Gary, was Larry a writer when you were on Saturday Night Live?
Yes, he was. He was the writer who never got a thing on the air.
I hired him. I hired him years later. The first show I ever produced, I was at Letterman as a segment producer, and I got offered a job at HBO to produce the Max Headroom talk show.
Sure.
And I took a leave of absence from Letterman, and I went to produce Max Headroom, and I hired Larry as a writer on the show. He couldn't get a piece on that show. He had his own voice. It was always very clearly Larry David's voice.
Yeah.
I go back now and I still have the material. I read the pieces that he wrote. He's writing Larry David pieces. You know, he wrote one piece, Max Headroom as a Nazi general.
Yeah.
And read it and it's hilarious, but it's, I remember at the time we said, we can't put this on TV.
It was the same thing at SNL. He wrote a piece and the entire piece was about two architects fighting over where the elevator operator's stool would be. That was the entire premise. Now you look at that, and now that you plug Larry David into it, you go, I wish I had seen it.
Robert, didn't you had a house in Tuscany, I believe?
I had a house in Italy, yep.
Didn't that become the premise of one of the Seinfeld episodes?
Yes, as a matter of fact. And Carol Leifer reminded me last night when I was dating, Jamie Tarsus passed away yesterday.
Mm, yes,
who was, great programmer and a network executive, and we had been together for a number of years. And Carol reminded me of this trip to Tuscany yesterday, and we all went to the house in Italy. And the rule at my house in Italy was very simple. I shared the house with a guy named Joe Allen, who everybody knows Joe Allen in New York and the theater.
Right.
It's a very famous restaurant. So we had this house, and Joe said to me, we can't tell people about it. If we tell people about the town, it's going to get overrun with Americans. They're going to tell this friend. They're going to tell that friend. They're going to spread it all over. So the rule was, if you came to our house, you weren't allowed to tell anybody about the town. That was the rule. And people would say, yeah, sure, okay. And they'd come, and it was what was so beautiful and wonderful about this experience was we were the only Americans.
Mm.
There were no other Americans for miles. And this is in the dead of summer, no Americans anywhere. And it was the most beautiful medieval town that you've ever seen. And, we were the only Americans, and the people in the town learned English because we didn't learn Italian. So we became celebrities in the town. It was amazing.
Somehow that found its way to the premise for the Seinfeld.
So Farrell came as a guest, and like we did with all the guests, I said, look, there's just one caveat here. Do not tell anybody about the town. So she came back. She was a writer on Seinfeld, and mm-hmm. she wrote an episode called The Maestro, which was about this character. And I love the guy that played the Maestro.
Yes.
I don't know his real name. Do you remember who he was?
No, but
From Animal House.
Guy from Animal House that played Niedermeyer.
Yeah. That's right.
And he was a conductor, and he would tell everybody he had a house in Tuscany. There are no houses available in Tuscany. No, you can't buy any more in Tuscany. There are no more houses there available.
Yeah.
And that was his thing. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Kurnis had a character named after him in Seinfeld.
You did?
Which character? Yeah, I had a writer on the show, and I was my character was, he was like the club manager at the Improv who gave out the spots and the times.
Oh, yeah.
And he gave Jerry, I mean, he had like two lines. And he gave Jerry's time at, I think the episode is called The Movie, where they're all waiting in line and they get off the line and back on. And I think Jerry gets off the line to get his time to after the film.
I do want to ask, I don't know, I think Lee mentioned to me you guys went out the other day and realized that you have no new stories. They're all old stories. Well, you know, that's what happens when most of our life is behind us. I would love to hear, though, in the Letterman show, what is the most outstanding or the biggest showbiz anecdote thing that you would categorize that happened on the Letterman show?
I don't know. They happened every night. That was the fun of the show.
What about the Joaquin Phoenix? Were you there? Were you producing when he did that?
That was way after that, wasn't it?
Oh, that was way after.
That was way after.
I was there for Crispin Glover. I was there for Harvey Keitel. I was there
Glover, yeah. I was in the audience.
I was there. Were you really?
Yeah.
I was there for Andy Kaufman. I was there for, you know, a lot of those episodes. Sonny and Cher, I was there for. Yeah. There's one I remember, though. It's I guess I could tell it. It was at the height of the AIDS thing. You know, the 80s. It was a very tough time. You know, it's interesting because I often tell my kids about it, especially now with the pandemic, you know, that we went through this before. Mm. You know, not on quite the elaborate scale with masks and things like that, but you know, not to sound crass, but do you remember the first time they said, all right, you got to use condoms?
Yeah.
And we were like, what? Got to use condoms? Ugh.
Yeah, you're right. That's
not real. So we can't use condoms. And then, you know, you have to. You got to wear masks. It's the same thing. But so at the height of the AIDS crisis, everybody was paranoid. Everybody was crazy. And I remember, especially in New York, and I remember we had Siegfried and Roy on the show. And I was like, they were booked. And a couple of days before the booking, before the show, I remember saying, I don't know if it was Kathy Vesipoli, who you had mentioned, or one of the talent bookers. I said, what are Siegfried and Roy going to do? Do we have to, you know, get ready for elaborate? Oh, they're not going to do anything. And I fucking blow my top. I'm like, what? I go, how do you book Siegfried and Roy? And they're not going to do a trick? They're not going to do a fucking illusion? Well, what are they going to do? What are they going to talk about? They don't speak English, for God's sake. No, Siegfried and Roy. So they say, oh, well, I said, tell their publicist, unless they do something, they can't come on. Just, it's that simple. I'm not going to have Siegfried and Roy on without a trick. So she talks to the publicist, comes back to me. She says, they'll come on with Baby Tigers. You can't cancel them. The publicist brings us a lot of guests, blah, blah, blah. I said, all right, we'll give them a short segment. They'll come on with their little Baby Tigers. They come on with the little Baby Tigers, and one of them scratches. I couldn't tell the difference between Siegfried and Roy, and I still can't. So either Siegfried or Roy starts bleeding, and he hands the tiger to Letterman, and a little bit of the blood gets on Letterman's hands. And we finish the show, and he calls me into his dressing room. What the fuck am I going to do? They just bled on me. And I said, well, what do you mean? Can I get AIDS? They're both gay. You know, I said, let me call somebody and I'll find out. This is how my job went every night. So a friend of mine was the former head of immunology at Mount Sinai Hospital. And he was a big immunologist. So I called him up and I said, you know, we had Tigers on the show tonight. I didn't want to say it was Letterman, but you know, my job was to protect him. So I said, and one of the handlers bled on me. And he instantly said, he goes, so Letterman freaked out? Yes, he did. Because he can't get it if they just bleed. If it bled on an open sore, if it bled on, you know.
Oh, right.
It, you know, those are the kind of stories. Every night there was something like this, whether it was involving Letterman or not, there was always an issue.
You know, what'd you think of the movie? Who portrayed you in the movie? What was it called, The Late Shift?
The Late Shift.
Yeah, The Late Shift.
Did you read the book and see the movie?
Yes, I did.
And?
Who did play you?
This actor named John Kaplos.
Chicago. Oh, John Kapler, Chicago. Yeah, I know John. Yeah, that's right.
Chicago actor, good character actor, very good,
good guy.
So, yeah, did you have any problems with the book or the movie?
The movie, I thought the guy was a little schlumpy. No offense to John, I think it was they dressed the character wrong, and I was a better dresser than they made that guy out to be. He was a little heavier than me.
But you don't have any dispute with the accuracy of what happened,
the story?
Really? No. Okay. No. Okay. It was pretty accurate. It was spot. I mean, it was pretty accurate because between Peter LaSalle, who was my co-exec, and myself, we gave Bill Carter the book, more or less. It was. There are two people who had the idea for Carter to write the book, and I'm credited as one. So Carter has always been very good to me because I said to him, you know, you should write a book about all this nonsense. And he goes, really?
Did Letterman have an opinion on the book or the movie?
Letterman said one of the funniest things ever about it. He goes, the guy that's playing me has red hair. And if you look at it, the guy that played him has red hair. He goes, it's not like there's no tape on me available. You can see what color hair I have. It's pretty accessible to get a tape.
So, really, I produced a pilot with him, John Michael Higgins.
And the other thing that Letterman got pissed off at was there's one scene where Letterman's supposedly, it's a weekend and he's at his house and somebody comes to visit him and he's in the backyard throwing softballs at an archery target. And he says, I never threw softballs at a target. Who the fuck does that? Those are the two things that he didn't like about the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting that in these kind of things that people, if they're not looking at what the facts are as much as who they got cast in that role, and is it flattering?
Right.
What about you? What?
I had no problem with the facts only because, and what I was saying is we gave him the idea to write the book. Then he interviewed us, and being that he was writing it independently of the New York Times, he was a TV writer for the New York Times, he said to us before, and he goes, look, I'm going to give you a transcript of everything you say. Go through the transcript, circle what you don't want, circle what you want, circle what you want off the record, blah, blah, blah. Mark things that aren't accurate, whatever. So we pretty much controlled the content of that book.
Lee, what about you? In your experiences, what's your favorite show business story that you tell? Who's the biggest celebrity you ever met?
I brought two pictures with me to show you guys, visual. Okay, here's a big celebrity I met. And by the way, I look so heavy in this picture. It's got to be it's about 15 years ago.
Well, for the podcast, I see a couple of big things.
Is that the porno actress?
That's Stormy Daniels.
Oh, Stormy, Stormy Daniels.
She had just asked me, that's backstage at a show that Robert and I had something to do with, and she had just asked me, do you think there's any way that they would let me on Celebrity Apprentice? And I said, I don't think so. I said, NBC is very conservative, the advertisers, and I said, can I ask you why? She goes, because Donald Trump won't leave me alone. That's what she said. Now, I liked when I first moved to LA in 92, there were still like classic celebrities. You know, I met Tony Curtis. A few. But this is in 1986. I went to Wimbledon with Robert, and he had all the, all the NBC passes and all the stuff, the behind the scenes and the free meals and all that. So at 3 o'clock one afternoon, I was watching a match in the main court, center court, and it was boring. So at 3 o'clock they would serve, tea and desserts and all that kind of stuff. So I went back and maybe there were 10, 15 tables in this tent, which they call a marquee. And I'm sitting reading a program, my head's down, and I see a couple come, but they're going to sit at my table and every other table's empty. And I hear the guy, and he goes, do you mind if we sit at your table?
Cary Grant. Did I guess right? Well, that just means you did a good impression. Oh, my God.
I did a...
So, that's the back of Cary Grant.
Yeah, it is the back.
You can't tell me that's Cary Grant.
Did you take a picture behind his back?
Yes.
As he was walking.
Because I was so embarrassed. You know, you had cameras. You didn't have phones that took pictures. I had a little camera. I was so embarrassed. Like, you know,
did you have a conversation with him?
Take a picture. Yeah.
I would have been completely intimidated. Morty, who's any person ever come on any of your shows that you went, holy shit, I can't believe this person?
When I met Cary Grant, it wasn't on one of my shows. I approached him about doing
a show
at a dinner, and that was pretty impressive, I would add. I met Betty Davis doing the show. You know, you meet a lot of, you know, Hank Aaron. You met everybody. Everybody.
But here's a good question, because I didn't do it when I was at MTV, and I went on tour with a lot of big stars. I went on tour with Bruce Springsteen. But because I didn't want I didn't want to impose on them, and I always didn't want them to think that, you know, you're taking advantage. I never asked for any photographs.
No.
Did you do backstage photographs with the people who came on the Letterman show, Morty?
Occasionally, yeah.
I have so many things that I never took a picture because I was like, I didn't want them to think that, right. You know. And besides, in those days, like Lee said, you had to have a camera.
Found a picture.
Yeah. You guys are going to have to send this to me so I can put them on full screen. Go ahead.
This you'll be able to see.
Oh, yep. It looks like
Johnny. It's Johnny. No, it's Morty. Oh, wow. Johnny.
Wow.
Me and Johnny after a few drinks.
And that is
where was that, at L.A. or New York?
That was in L.A., yep. That was at Granita Restaurant in Malibu.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's where I saw Carson. I was at Granita, and I saw him there with
he was a part owner.
Oh, that's why, okay.
And used to eat there every weekend.
And I've always heard, I'm sure Johnny was different with everybody. I mean, he's an icon for me, is that socially in public, just in stuff, he wasn't like he'd be a funny guy.
No, but a lovely guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Sweet, you know, if he liked you.
Right.
And yeah. he always liked me and was always very, very good to me.
What was his reaction to Leno getting the job?
He thought it was an injustice. He hated it.
Oh, he did.
Hated it. You know, look, when he came back, the last appearance Johnny Carson made was he did a walk-on the Letterman show. He never made an appearance on The Tonight Show after he left.
No.
But he went on Letterman, and that was the last time he was on TV.
Moving ahead, a couple of things I want to get into. Late night wars that go on now and that whole world of, I mean, it's so different from back in the day with your guys. Should you bring out a comic? Do comics go on any of these shows anymore?
Not without audiences, I don't think.
Well, forget COVID. Even when you had audiences, it seems to me, I mean, late night, they do a lot more sketches, right? Yeah. So they need to do stuff that goes viral.
Hey, you look at these credits on these shows. They have 20, 25 writers on these shows.
Yeah.
It's insane. You know?
And it's how political. I mean, look at Colbert. I mean, it's so political. Letterman wasn't political, was he?
That's what you want? No. Used to stay away from politics. You know, and that was because Letterman was very much in the mold of Carson. And you never knew if Carson was a Republican or a Democrat. Right. You never knew. You know, and Letterman was the same. Toward the end, Letterman let his liberal,
We know now his anti-Trump, you know, that's really brought the fire out.
But you never knew in the old days, and it was all apolitical. And, you know, there was also something called the Fairness Doctrine.
That's right. Which,
you know, and equal time. And
I blame Ronald Reagan.
Yep. And, you know, if I remember once we did when we were doing the show at NBC, across the hall was a studio where they did the local news. And they had, you know, interview guests on this show, Live at 5, it was called, on WNBC.
With Chuck Scarborough.
That's right. So one year they had Dukakis. He was running for president. And Letterman said, go get him, Morty. So, you know, on air, I went out and went across the hall and I dragged Dukakis back into the studio and he gave a wave, blah, blah, blah. And the next day I get a call from, you know, this guy who's some fringe candidate. I don't know even what party he was, independent, obviously. And he was asking for equal time. And I said to NBC, well, do I have to give Matt equal time? He goes, yeah, you got to give him by law. You have to give every candidate.
I wish they still had that today.
Every declared candidate. I was lucky that only one asked for it.
Right. Yeah.
And it turns out the topper to this story was, I looked the guy up. I don't remember his name. I looked him up, and he was a burn victim and was burned. 90% of his body was scarred from burns. His face was totally disfigured, his hands. And I remember calling his people and saying, I don't mean to be rude, but this is a comedy show. And the way we had it structured was because we didn't want him to do any bit. We didn't know anything about this guy. He was going to walk on the same way that Dukakis walked on. And that was going to be kind of the joke, and you didn't recognize him. And I said, this guy's going to walk out and people are going to kind of laugh because we do a comedy show. They're not going to know that this is a real man who went through some tragedy, blah, blah, blah. And I remember when we taped it, we stopped down and Letterman told the audience the whole story.
Right.
And he said, this guy's a very courageous guy. And I remember he was a lovely guy and he came out and he did some banter with Letterman and, you know, it was entertaining and he couldn't have been nicer about it, but it was, wow. It was an odd circumstance.
Wow. Wow. Lee, where would you find, I know
I'm a Libra.
Clubs are closed. I know comedy clubs are closed, but let's say before COVID and in the time of TikTok, it seems to me that the talent that's really the money makers are not the people who are the road warriors for comedians anymore, but the person that can get a lot of followers on TikTok or YouTube. That's where the money is, right?
Well, first, let me correct you, because even though I don't
see, he's really the explaining Jew.
Even though I don't have clients who play clubs a lot, clubs are open around the country. There are a lot of states that clubs are doing well, and they've cut down their capacity. But it's like I talked to an agent the other day. He said, if it wasn't for the clubs, I'd be out of business. So, I just think it's such a different. It's a different time. Morty's talking about the Letterman show and Carson show. And it's like, if you had one great shot as a comic on those shows in the day, it came a little less so later on, but in the day, people were talking about you the next day, you had offers, your agent's phone, blew up, all this stuff happened. None of that stuff happens anymore. There are people who've done the show 6-7 times and they're not necessarily, big names or anything. And the truth of the matter is, and that's been, if you want to say taken away by everything that's happening on social media. I mean, I heard of a guy who was a very successful manager who sold his company, made a lot of money, and he's coming back in the business just to manage YouTube, TikTok, Instagram people.
I imagine if you're a manager and agent, you're spending all of your day just swiping on your phone. That's your whole day, just swiping and looking for the one diamond in the rough that nobody else sees and tries to get.
Yeah, I found a guy about 6 years ago. Penn and Teller did their show Fool Us in London before they did it here on the CW. And I see this guy is dressed in a dragon outfit. And he does comedy magic. And I thought, wow, this guy's got something interesting. And it's like, you can make fun of it or you can go with it. I'm drawn to and understand performers. What I don't understand is, okay, so there's some kid who opens, famous kid, more famous probably than any client I've ever worked with. He opens presents. Little kid opens presents. That's his thing. He has 50 million subscribers.
There's a dozen examples of that.
Right, but the kid,
there's a guy out who reacts to old music and has like 50 million
But this
followers.
Kid, advertisers pay so much money to be integrated in. This kid will never be lacking. He must be 11 years old now.
I don't think show business is – I mean, it's a completely different business. I'm not even sure if – could you call somebody who's making videos of themselves reacting to old music show business?
But I think as a, look, as a,
because that's
a
what
manager,
I wanted to be, and I wanted to be in show business.
Right. But I think as someone who, either produces or writes or directs, talent in some way, like I do overseas talent, you have to be, look, what my strength is not, okay, so what's the kid's career or opens presents? I don't know. I have no idea.
Right, exactly.
I mean, nor do I mean, you know, do I know that business enough to say, okay, you made $5 million this year. I'm going to make you $10 million. I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, no, it's all you know, hashtagging and marketing.
But you know, saying 10 years ago, someone would have said the same about a guy in a dragon suit doing magic.
Well, you know? I totally understand that, but there's a talent behind that. Whereas the kid opening presents, I don't know what the talent is. People seem to like it. But
well, it's insatiable. People are on this, phone, all the time. So I mean, it's just content.
That's one thing. You have young kids and you see that. It's amazing.
Well,
amazing.
And yeah.
Kids don't watch traditional TV. They haven't watched traditional TV in 10 years.
I know. No. Wanting to move along, because when I met you, Lee, you were in commercial real estate. And yes. I met Morty, he was in the business. Now you're in the business and Morty's in not commercial real estate, but in real estate. So Morty,
can I ask a question? I interrupted you.
No, just that, what was it that made you decide to, you know, hang up your show business hat and move it into the real estate business?
I often say that I got out of show business. I tired of the show business at exactly the same time that the show business tired of me.
Right.
And, you know, you just move on. It's, you know, I got my Emmys. I've got my money. I got whatever I wanted out of show business. Met everybody, did everything. I did comedy shows. I did sitcoms. You know, I've done everything that I wanted to do. And coincidentally, it was at a time when the financial model didn't kind of suit what I was used to. And I was getting offered lesser jobs for lesser money. And whenever I did make money, I would invest in real estate. I'd buy a house here. I'd buy a house there. And I always made really good profits selling. So I said to myself, geez, I really enjoy that business. And I'm really good at that business. So, you know, even though it's semi-retirement, I don't, you know, I'm not as driven as most. I take what comes my way. I'm not like crazy on the phone, and you know, I'm not that kind of guy. But I'm doing well, and I enjoy it. I sell mostly in Malibu, so you know, the houses are, you know, in the $8-9 million range.
You're living the lifestyle.
Yeah, and it's nice.
It's nice. It is nice.
I admire you.
I know that market. You know, I sell to showbiz. I work with a lot of showbiz people. You know, and it's fun out here.
Do you have any relationship with Letterman anymore or no?
We got together, I don't know, when he retired, they had a party and I saw him there. Mm-hmm. But no, not a real relationship. I mean, occasionally I text him and he texts back, but not a real relationship.
Well, I'll tell you the other thing that the three of us probably have, four of us are dealing with, which is in my case, and I realize that it's just a natural evolution, but what happened to me was because there were so many quotas that they had to fill for women and minorities that a lot of these directing jobs went away. I mean, I literally got told by a very big head of a network that they would love to give me episodes, but they have so much pressure to get people and women to give them shots. And so it really made a lot much more difficult for me to get the gig. So unfortunately, I have a DGA pension or whatever. So that kind of, I wasn't done directing. You know, it was and then COVID hit.
Yeah.
You know,
I wasn't done acting, but I used to say, hey, I can't get arrested. No, actually, that's the one thing I could do.
Oh, you could do, yeah.
Well, I left when the industry stopped looking at actors and just started going into reality. And I just said, you know what, I got to make a living.
Honestly, that's when it turned for me also. When reality came and, you know, I started getting off of these reality shows. I was like, I don't want to do stunt shows. That's not what I want to do for a living. And I still don't. So,
Lee, give us your coda to all of this.
My coda.
I can't believe you're not prepared for a coda question.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, how do I work in the final line of Kenny? How
of course
you
were. Yeah,
I was thinking, where is that?
I'm ready with a coda question. I've been waiting.
Listen, I don't think anything will ever replace entertainment as a whole. But, you know, Morty, one of his first jobs, he told me, was he sold subscriptions to Manhattan Cable. Like, who needs Manhattan Cable? Who needs cable? Who needs, I just got rid of satellite after 20 years. I got rid of DirecTV. It was costing a fortune. I was like, what? Someone told me about YouTube TV, which has all local channels, and then you get your apps on Apple TV. It's a pleasure. So, you know, there are big changes and subtle changes, and you just have to roll with it. You know, if you're someone who does what I do, you got to roll with it and constantly sort of learn some new tricks, new things.
Which is why, actually, I think it is kind of important that I have, me and Gary have our friends on and talk about this. Because in a lot of ways, the show business for our parents and us was kind of similar. You know, their stars and our stars. And they told show business stories and all that kind of stuff. That's why I love doing this and getting it down and hearing you guys talk about it, because it is for the record. Because you're not going to have these experiences anymore from people. You're not going to have anecdotes of YouTube stars or TikTok people coming on and telling show business anecdotes, because we're all in our little world, a little fragmented thing. So, you know.
So this is for the time capsule.
Yeah, this is for the time capsule.
But I want to.
Right now.
Go ahead, Lee.
No, I want to say one other thing. It's a business of change, and now with what's happening digitally, it's going to be a world.
Yeah, I think it's seismic. I think the transition from radio and our parents' generation was not seismic in terms of we all.
Radio to TV.
But the people came from radio. The big stars of radio just went on to TV, and people were familiar with them because they heard.
Okay, we're creating a new genre.
Now there are so many celebrities out there that 90% of us have not heard of.
Yeah,
well, that are making tens of millions.
There's a difference between. Here's what's changed. That a celebrity used to be an actor, a musician, a singer, an artist. You know, something.
Somebody
like
with talent.
Right. Okay. But you said that I didn't. Okay.
Well, no, I believe that.
Well,
what talent did the Kardashians have? What was their talent?
There's some talent there to do what they do in front of a camera, but that's about it. What?
Did you see the interview that Letterman did with Kim Kardashian?
Yes.
Yes.
And how he said to her, he said, you know, I have to apologize to you because I underestimated what you did for a living and how you made your fame and your fortune.
She created a brand.
Right.
Every aspect of marketing business.
The fact that they did that television show, which is all invasive, for so many years, and the preparation that went into her personally and things like that, he said, I apologize to you. You work hard.
I don't doubt that they work hard. All I'm saying is that I think there's a distinction between people that have a particular talent, which is acting, writing, direct, creative people.
But there's a talent now.
It's a different talent. Right. But I'm just saying I believe there's a distinction.
Become a talent.
Exactly right.
I have a friend of mine's son doesn't know what he wants to do, but he wants to become famous. That's his goal.
Yeah, and that's where you can make a lot of money. That's all you need.
Yeah.
Well, but
yeah, so
point,
it's
though,
just a different, yeah.
It's different. Lee gave us a coda, Ken. It was a coda's coda.
Yeah, okay.
It's just different, and we're going to figure out how to navigate these waters. you have talent to manage. Robert, you have houses to sell. Ken, you've got time to kill, and I have children to feed.
Okay.
So we have several great codas here. You know,
well, I want to thank them both for coming on. I hope you guys had a good time.
I hope you did.
I'd love to have come back.
Morty, you never invited me to Italy, even after the blowjob on the sixth floor at 30 Rock.
I would love to have. No more, boy. It kills me. You know, I look back on my youth. I lived in Malibu. I lived in Italy. Now I got nothing. I got a house in Venice.
Oh, yeah, we can see the house. It's beautiful. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Thanks for the fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for the stories.
Thanks so much.
Kenneth, thank you for your friendship. And we'll see you guys down the road. All right. Folks, thanks for watching. We're on iHeartRadio, Pandora. What else are we on, Kenny? We're on the YouTube channel. And we're on Apple TV? Apple Podcast. Apple TV. Right. So you'll find us.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Whatever we're called. See you guys.
Bye.